Welcome back to Beyond the Tech, a Brian and Alex production. I'm your host, Brian McDonald, founder and CEO of The Digital Board. And again, today I'm joined by my co-host, Alex Alexander, former CTO and now founder of Zoots. Beyond the Tech is a brand new podcast where we talk to some of the world's most inspirational tech leaders who are today helping shape and influence the future of business through both innovation and exceptional change leadership. Our hope in these podcasts is that we can learn some of their secrets while exploring their journey from their early beginnings, hearing some of the bold moves they made to become the prominent leaders they are today. Well, today I'm really excited to welcome a very special guest. Not only is he a distinguished figure in the world of tech, a former group CIO of Walgreens Boots Alliance, a Fortune 100 company, but he's also a very dear friend of mine and has been a trusted collaborator for over 13 years. Our journey began outside the elevators of Heidrick & Struggles back in 2011. And since then, we've collaborated on numerous adventures, enjoying regular catch-ups over dinner, discussing art, culture, business, and of course, technology. Even the pandemic didn't get in the way of that, as we decided that the coolest way to stay connected at that time was by taking cycling trips across London. In the podcast, we talk about pivotal moments in his career, from his relatively humble beginnings through to his groundbreaking work in integrating cutting-edge technologies into Walgreens. We explore more recently his advisory roles in leading startups and enterprises, as well as the non-executive career that he's following. I'm also really delighted to introduce him to my co-host, Alex, as they share both a passion for technology as well as Italy. So let's get started. Well, welcome, Anthony. It's fantastic to have you on our podcast. Thank you for joining us. I've been excited about this for quite some time. How are you?
Very good, thank you. It's great to be here, great to be here virtually, I should say, because we're all in different places. Yeah, I'm fine. You find me in London, in my home in London. And yes, getting on with the usual things, which I'm sure we'll get into later on during this conversation.
Nice. Well, it's not often you're in London these days. You're globetrotting around the place, often in Italy. So how long are you in London for?
Well, we go back to Italy on actually next Monday. I'll be out there again. I'm not sure I'm globetrotting that much. I might do a lot more travel when I worked for WBA. I was doing 2 weeks London, 2 weeks Chicago for 7 years. So anything now seems like a lot less there. And I can balance it a lot better now, which is nice.
Nice. And Alex, welcome. How are you doing?
Nice to see both of you. I'm good, thinking about the conference that I've got to attend tomorrow in Paris with ministers to talk about AI. I'm in Italy and living by the seaside, thinking about what I was going to say. But maybe since we are kind of neighbors in Italy, at some point we should share our experiences and our love for Italy.
Yeah, well, I'm in the Venice area. You're in the Bologna area, so yeah. not too far away.
Not too far. Not too far at all. So I'm sure we can organize something soon. Fantastic.
So Alex, you were down on the beach. You were getting your head in the right space for meeting a bunch of ministers. Sounds fun. Sounds exciting.
Yeah, taking advantage, just thinking about how I'm going to position this with ministers, which initially I thought it was just going to be European ministers, but there are far away as New Zealand, Korea, US, and other places. So it would be interesting. I'm looking forward to it, but I need to be prepped.
Well, as always, I'm somewhere else at the moment in my house here in the south of France, which you would think would be beautiful and sunny and shiny, but it's wet and rainy. So feeling very at home. But having just come back from the Netherlands, I was out in Amsterdam, actually, Andrew, with one of your old colleagues, Grant Ecker, who was the chief enterprise architect at WBA. He runs a fantastic chief architect forum as a night job, connecting chief architects around the world. So there was representation from the Nordics, from the US, from UK, from the Netherlands, of course, because we were in Dell's headquarters. And I was doing a little talk on leadership. So that was fun.
It's fascinating how the network of people you meet through a career just grows and grows. And you know, LinkedIn has become really such an essential tool now, because all of our contacts and connections are now scattered across the globe, all doing different things, but we all are still able to keep in touch with each other.
Yeah, it was really nice because Grant posted the picture of us at this fireside talk that we're doing. And then Steve Rempel dropped us both a really lovely note saying two of my favorite people. So he was being very nice. Okay, Anthony, you and I have known each other for quite some time now. I think it's 13 years.
Meeting you outside of Lift and Hydrogen Struggles, and that's where we had our first meeting. And the rest, as they say, is history.
That's true. I just remember saying, I'm setting up this business. I'd love to meet you. And we've done a lot of work together. I don't know how many hires that I made for, well, what became Walgreens Boots Alliance. But there were definitely a number of leaders that we brought in. We might talk a little bit about them later on.
At the risk of this becoming the Mutual Admiration Society, you did actually have one of the highest success rates of placing people at WBA and of them surviving as well. So well done.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you. Well, look, as an introduction, we're going to try and talk about today is, of course, Anthony and your role as a group CIO in a Fortune 100 company where the scale of ambition is quite unparalleled. And I'd love to hear a little bit about some of the challenges that you face as a leader. We will obviously take a little bit of a look back in your career, how we got there, where it all started. I'm sure that's going to be quite fascinating. I think I want to talk about you as a people leader. So I want to have you share some of your stories because, you know, that's what I think one of your super strengths is, connecting the dots and bringing people with you. And many people have some of that skill. I think you have it in abundance. So I'd love to ask you some awkward questions to make you reveal all about that. I want to talk about where we are in tech today. It's not lost on anybody that we are in a wholly different paradigm all of a sudden, where generative AI is exploding. We've got new technologies that are hitting us, quantum compute, machine learning. And I'd love to get your perspective, both from just on a high level generic sense of where we think we are in that journey, what maybe to come, and where that applies in businesses in healthcare or other, and get your perspective on some of that. And then, of course, I want to talk a little bit about your pivot from executive to career to what you're doing today around the non-exec and advisory. And maybe that's a good segue in just how do you describe yourself today?
Yeah, it's always a challenging one. It's one that I've sort of refined over the years because people do like labels, don't they? They like to know, well, what are you? So I describe myself as an independent director, investor, and business advisor. But that's kind of a little dry, isn't it? It's better to talk more about, you know, what I do than just having a label. So having finished with the corporate world back at the end of 2019, just before the pandemic, I really focus on three areas of activities: non-executive, board, advisory work, and consulting. So I serve on the board of Rackspace, which is a public NASDAQ quoted company. I'm going to be joining the board of Hitachi Digital Services soon. And I also work with Photon Technologies on their advisory board. I also do quite a lot of consulting for professional services companies, for private equity companies. But in general, I'm moving more towards board type activities and less consulting. So that's like one block of activities. I sometimes call that my real job because I get paid for those things. The second area is both me and my partner, we invest in early stage technology companies. It doesn't have to be sector specific. And people think that because of my background in healthcare and retail, it's all there. But actually, no, we can talk about some of these later on. But they all have a technology element in them. They're all very much before the stage that the VCs will get involved in them. And they're fascinating. You know, it helps to keep me fresh from a technology perspective because I get exposed to a lot of emerging tech. But it also allows me to use the benefit of my experience with these very small organizations. And the third area is something I have a real passion for at the moment. It's a UK charity, a non-profit organization called Venice in Peril. I'm the vice chair of that charity. So it's a UK-based charity which raises funds for the protection and for conservation efforts in Venice. So they're trying to preserve the city's culture for a city which does have many challenges, which are well-known and well-described. So I spend quite a lot of time doing that. And of course, with our place in the Veneto, we're very close to Venice and able to work there quite a lot. So it gives me a great deal of pleasure. I find it quite rewarding. And I do think when you get to a certain stage in life, it is good to give something back, to try and do something more than just a pure business activity. So yeah, a Venice in Peril is very important to me.
Fantastic. Well, we are going to talk a little bit about the other stuff later. And I would love to take a little bit of a look back in your career. But before we do that, can we just frame this? Can you give everybody a sense of the role you were doing last? It was pre-pandemic. And I remember in the pandemic, you and I going out cycling and catching up.
Yeah. The pandemic was quite an interesting fire break, actually. It exactly coincided with my leaving WBA. I was actually still supporting them in an advisory capacity. I was with the Walgreens Boots Alliance and its predecessor companies for 16 years. My role there was global CIO. That's the technical description of it. But in practice, what it meant was my remit was anything to do with technology across that organization. And the organization is not just Walgreens in the US or Boots in the UK. It was actually across 25 different countries, ranging from joint ventures in China to a pharmacy business in Mexico to wholesale businesses right across the globe. So it was a very substantial and complex organization, which Stefano Sina had built up over many years. And at its peak, to be honest, it was, if I remember correctly, it was about $100 billion market cap, $140 billion revenue, and as I said, across 25 countries. So a really a scale organization.
And the fun thing is we're going to pivot to the how did it all begin? And thinking about one of those questions, like when you think about back in your early days, even studying, do you ever imagine sitting as an executive leader in an organization of that scale, that, you know, enormity?
I come from a town called Worthing on the south coast in Sussex. And I can remember very well going on the bus down to school, going to St. Andrew's School, you know, at about the age of like 15, 16, thinking, oh, what am I going to do? And I remember going to these, do you remember career advisors?
So
what do you want to do? Do you want to get a job in a bank or do you want to get a job working, you know, all these kind of things, try to map out. I would never have in a million years imagined I would end up doing what I've done. And in fact, this is true for so many people. The jobs that we do, the work, the activities, the way we spend our lives, didn't exist in that way back then. So these poor career consultants could never have really given any help.
Yeah. What I'm super interested to explore, Anthony, is that where did it all begin? Because your super strength seems to be about people. And I'm really interested in your passion for languages. And of course, you're studying languages, not in a fun way, in a very serious way. And how did it all begin and connected to the languages, connect to people? Because I also felt that connection with you when we first met.
Yeah, well, I always had an interest in languages. From school days, I did modern languages at university. I did what I wanted to do, I suppose, is the truth. I think that nowadays people are very concerned when they look at the careers and things that they study, they're very concerned to be doing the right thing and getting all the right ticks in the boxes. I didn't really think about that. I just thought about what I wanted to do. So I did languages. And of course, I came out of university with no skills, which I suppose is the British system in many ways. You come out of university with a good brain. You then get taken on by a company who puts you through a graduate program. So I duly went through that. And I came out at the end of that as a graduate trainee for an international reinsurance company in the City of London, which seemed as good as anything else and they actually wanted language graduates, to be fair, because of the nature of their business. But I didn't use my languages, and I was clearly not going to be a very good underwriter. So therein lay a problem and an opportunity. The opportunity was that in this company, they had their first IBM AT computer, which some of your listeners may know what I'm talking about, but it was basically the first business, or one of the first business computers that was used widely. And I was left to my own devices to play around on this piece of technology. And I taught myself a bit of basic. I taught myself how to mess around with early spreadsheets and things and created some solutions for my bosses at the time. They said, this is great, Anthony. You can carry on doing that, forget the underwriting. And then I applied for a job. Very bullish of me. I applied for a job with United Parcel Service, who were setting up in the UK and wanted some IT leaders. Well, not leaders. We were project managers. We were junior people. And I have to say, I'm very grateful to United Parcel Service, who I stayed with for 3 years, and then to PepsiCo, who I was with for, I think, about 7 years, because those two companies effectively gave me the training and taught me the business of IT in some considerable detail. You know, UPS took me to the States. They put me in their data centers. I worked on a number of things there. PepsiCo sent me all around Europe. So I came out of that, strangely, with a very good technical knowledge. And back to the Italian thing, this is fascinating. So PepsiCo said, well, we have this role in Milan, Italy, for an IT manager. We're just setting up a business there. And we think you could do it, but unfortunately, we need someone who can speak Italian. And Italian wasn't the language that I studied at university. So I said, I can do that. They said, well, you've got 3 months. If you can learn enough Italian in 3 months, then you can have the job. And I got the job. So I went, and that was my first encounter with Italy, first of three, actually, three major times I spent in Italy. But it was, you know, it was a great opportunity. That's a very long answer, but that's kind of how I got into what I did for the rest of my career.
I'm really fascinated to learn about the NGO work that you did as well, because I understand that took you to another part of Italy, Rome. What got you there, and also what connections you made from that role, which is, seems really unusual, but super interesting.
It is. This is an important point, because I have, in recent years, I've done a number of presentations where people have said to me, particularly, you know, people at an early stage in their career, how did you do what you did? How did you get to where you are? As if there's some sort of playbook you can follow. And I can actually turn my career history into something that looks very well organized, very well planned. The truth, Alex, is that, like most careers, it's opportunistic. You take the opportunities when they come up and you make the most of them. I used to work with Alex Gourley, who was the managing director at Walgreens. And he had a very good expression, which I took to heart, actually, when he said, for any of these things, it's a footballing analogy. You have to be put yourself in play. If you're not in play, you're not in the game and you can't do these things. You don't know necessarily how things are going to work out. And I can't say that I planned every stage of my career. How I ended up working in Rome for the multinational forces of observers is because prior to that, I left PepsiCo to do a startup called agriflow.com back in the year 2000. And it was a really fascinating experience, very, very hard work. Somebody said to me, I think it's a compliment, they said, oh, do you realize you're a .com veteran? I said, I suppose I am. But dear old Agriflow, whilst being an amazing experience, did not have the success that Amazon had back in 2000. Amazon survived. We didn't. So I found myself literally out of my ear with nothing to do. And I got a call from this NGO in Rome saying, would you like to come to Rome and be our director of information systems for this non-governmental organization, which based out of Rome manages the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, looks after the technology for that. Initially, I said, I don't think that's really me. I'm sort of, you know, commercial, and I've never worked in that sort of sector before. But there again, you get the opportunity to go and live and work in Rome for a few years. I thought, oh, why not? So it turned out to be a fascinating experience. Suddenly, I find myself working in an organization which is non-governmental. It's effectively run as a military organization. So it operates through command and control. So you have to use a quite different skill set to be able to get things done. It's equally effective, by the way. It's no less effective than some of the practices that you see in the commercial and private sector, but it's different. And I've learned over the years that one has to be a little bit humble about the way that organizations work, the way that cultures evolve. And you can't say that this one is right and that one is wrong, this one is good, that one is bad. They've all evolved and worked for certain reasons. And what you have to do as an individual is find ways of adapting and flexing your personal style so that you can get the most out of the people that you work with, and then they can get the best out of you as well.
Anthony, I want to jump in for a second, because I'm plotting in my own head this sort of journey that you're on, which it sounds partly opportunistic, because at that stage of your life, you follow opportunity, you're curious, you're learning different cultures, you're learning things you don't know you're learning as well, right? You're learning things about how a UPS operates, and then a Pepsi, and then going to Italy. You're getting into a startup. I remember you and I had this conversation about the startup and the things that you had to worry about then. Like you've got eight different gears operating simultaneously. And then you find yourself in this NGO because it's different and it's going to broaden you in a way that you can't quite anticipate. As you're 6 months in, you're beginning to assimilate all these different things that you've learned in different cultures and different styles. And it's then informing you that you're clearly quite adaptable. You're quite able to operate with a different mindset. Are you aware of that at this stage?
I definitely understood my strengths. I think it's, you know, the way I work with people is about having, as I said, a respect for different cultures, different people, and the way in which they work. Now, it's interesting today because the society and the world of work is kind of trying to codify that. And these are all led by a board or by an executive team. You do these things, you have a certain number of things. I had a much more empirical view of that, which is you encourage different people to be part of your teams. If they're not part of your teams, you find different ways of working with them. You explore that diversity of thought and of culture. And from that, you yourself grow as an individual, and you can also help other people grow as well. And you can also work with them. So I think that's where I was coming from. But I don't think I would have been quite as articulated about that as I am now.
Many leaders will talk about suffering from some form of imposter syndrome when they get a big job, right? And that's basically because they look at themselves and think, oh my God, can I do this? But actually all the programming en route to that level of understanding and confidence and the ability to adapt and flex and work with people. I guess where I was going was, were you getting a sense of these are the critical skills of a leader, regardless if I'm running technology or finance or whatever it is, these are the critical skills of leadership that might serve me well?
Yes, I think that's definitely true. I knew then, and I know now even more, that the technology is not the solution. Back in the day, the technology wasn't as sophisticated. We certainly had more challenges with the technology. But even then, it was about creating the right environment for that technology to be successful. It's even more true now because the technology can do pretty much anything we need it to. But guess what? We have the same problems with all the things that have always existed. And a lot of that is to do with the way in which companies organize themselves and the way in which leaders lead within those companies.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah. If I could just pick up on the point that is absolutely crystal clear to me, that you as a people leader ingrained yourself in the culture. So you're not just culturally aware, you actually embed yourself in the culture. And that's also the power as well. I'm also sensing that you're a storyteller, you're a translator, you're able to translate opportunities into real things, but also you're able to give an opportunity to somebody else. So I'm really keen to understand, who are the people that actually shaped and influenced you as a leader?
I think in all of the companies I worked, there was always at least one person. I go right back to that very first, the first reinsurance company. The first person who gave me a job was also the manager who gave me the time to go and do a little bit of basic program on that IBM AT. And there have been people that have given me that opportunity at various stages in my career. But I don't think it's just about, you know, looking up to other leaders. I think it's also about looking sideways. I look at the people that I used to work with at say PepsiCo, and you know, we were all junior middle ranking people doing our things, but we work, you know, pretty closely as a team. Right? And there's Rachel Osborne, who's now the chief exec of Ted Baker, and Tim Davey, who's now the director general of the BBC. He was the Pepsi brand manager. So all of these type of people that you work with, you learn from them and you start to establish good collaborative working practices. And I think this is the way that one grows as an individual. It's not just looking at, you know, some leader who inspires you, but it's also about learning from people. And what I've tried to do with the teams that I've built is to give them the opportunity to grow in the same way. Now, I wouldn't necessarily call it mentorship, but I certainly spent a lot of time with my team members, giving them opportunities to do things that maybe they hadn't done before, as people did for me. I was quite often put into a situation where I didn't necessarily have the experience. My bosses at Walgreens Boots Alliance certainly gave me a lot of scope to do other things. And I tried to do that for some of my teams. And I think people really appreciate that ability. And if they're working within a team where they can grow and develop, it's a great opportunity.
And it's really interesting, Anthony. And we're going to come on to what I think about you as a people leader, because I have the added advantage of having recruited somewhere in the region of 20 plus people for you. So first of all, they'll talk about the stretch challenge of working in a business like Walgreens Boots Alliance and how ambitious the ownership and the leadership is and how that manifests itself into challenging roles. And the second thing, and they very quickly pivot to say, but Anthony is a fantastic leader because he's able to give me that space and support, and he always has time, whether it's the 10 minutes I need or if it's an hour sit down. And that isn't always an easy thing to give, particularly when you've got phenomenal challenge and pressure on your time, but to give them the feeling that they're important, they're the only person in the room at that time that matters, and that's what we're going to do. And so we'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. I want to jump back into that role at Walgreens, because I remember you picking up the phone and telling me that this has happened and you're becoming Group CIO. A phenomenally large job with an awful lot of challenge to get your head around very quickly. People talk about your first 100 days, it got shortened to 90. Can you talk us through a little bit as much as you can about those early days and how you began to think about how am I going to lead this size of an organization with this level of ambition?
You were talking earlier on about imposter syndrome. And I must admit, when I sat in Walgreens for the first time thinking about the challenges ahead, the size of the job, and just the things that we needed to get done, it was quite overwhelming. But the interesting thing about those early days, we kind of suffered an existential problem almost immediately. So within a very, very short time of my taking that role, Walgreens managed to hit the front page of the Wall Street Journal because its pharmacy system had a catastrophic failure. And I think the headline in the Wall Street Journal was, if you're planning on refilling your script at Walgreens this weekend, think again. So downside, lots of pressure. Upside, of course, great focus on the importance of technology. So I started very early on to try and think about what were the things that we needed to do there, not just in Walgreens, also in Boots, also in other geographies as well. And of course, I was working for Stefano Pessina and Ornella Barra. Stefano's an engineer. As an engineer, he believes very much in building things for the long term. So I guess I have a slightly half open door there in that I had a very architecturally driven view of what we should be doing around retail, around pharmacy and healthcare, as well as the kind of emerging changes that were starting to happen in digital and mobile. So the first thing was to try and, in my own mind, just frame what that needs to look like. And then to think about what is the team that we need to have to deliver that. Because I had a very fragmented team of fiefdoms of people in different geographies and different areas. Yeah, and very much a matrix and decentralized structure. How to bring that together? And very early came up with the concept of what I call one IT. And so one IT basically meant that whether you had a direct line report into me, which everybody wanted, by the way, which was not practical, or an indirect line through another leader, or an even more indirect line through a business unit and the managing director, you're all part of the one IT team. And, you know, we spent quite a lot of time building that culture and building the structures and the communications patterns that were needed to make that successful. And I think we really got there because I was following a guideline that, you know, Walgreens Boots Alliance was a global organization and was going to operate as a global organization. Now, if the direction had been, no, we are a holding company and every business works a different way, and I think we would have gone about it a rather different way. But you know, the remit was build a company, get the synergies that you get from a global organization. But at the same time, make sure you can be local enough to respond to your customers, to your patients in that particular geography. So fascinating challenge. This is something that many companies face. And again, there's no right or wrong answer. It's about creating the technology team that can correctly respond to that overall strategic direction.
Some observations, though. I mean, on one level, fantastic to have a leader like Stefano, who's got an engineering mindset, but also relentlessly ambitious. And I don't remember the quote you once gave me, the one-liner that he has.
Yeah. So we had a mantra of double-digit growth. So Stefano wanted double-digit growth every year. And one of his famous saying was, double-digit growth is not just a number, it's an attitude of mind.
Yeah. And you have to interpret and cascade that through an organization at the same time you're trying to glue them together under a one IT culture. Did you have a set of underpinning tenets that glued that one IT culture? Did you have core principles that define us as a one IT? How did you go about cementing that culture so you knew it would stand rigor?
I think the most important thing that I tried to do was to make sure that the strategy that we had was coherent with that. If I was to come up with one thing, it is trust. Trust that Stefano and Ornella put in me, and also the trust which I gave to my team members. I think I gave quite a lot of freedom and flexibility, but that was all based on the trust relationship that we had. We had a successful development team in Naples, which I think you know quite well, Brian. And that for me was almost the ultimate representation of a trust relationship, because huge skepticism. Why are you developing software in Naples? Who are these people? Da, 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 da. This team had been part of Stefano's organization right back to even before I'd been a part of WBA. And it was a group of technology leaders who were great technologists, they were great individuals. But most important thing is they had absolute trust and loyalty to Stefano, but also to me to get things done. And when you've got that sort of commitment and that sort of loyalty, you can really overcome any sort of barriers. And so I think I tried very much to imbue that in the teams that I work with, because I think it's a very important value. Trust and respect. I mentioned respect earlier on. If you've got those two things, you've really got everything that you need.
And I would describe that to leaders that I was attracting for you, to try and explain to them the culture, because a lot of them in early conversations would be coming from slightly more traditional large-scale corporates who have got institutionalized leadership that you just fit into the next generation, and it looks a little bit like the one that went before it. And we would have to filter out a lot of those people quite quickly, because I was really looking for entrepreneurs who were able to operate on a ridiculous scale. Right? Driven very much by these two very influential leaders. But the people that we needed back then were, yeah, for sure, super smart around the core technology's purpose, but how to impact an organization's ambition and bring leadership to that and trust that you're on the right direction, even though it's going to get tough. And it's going to be really tough, particularly for people in their first 6 months, that they were not ready, no matter how prepped, you talked about my success rate, but how prepped they were not ready for this level of intensity. The scrutiny right from the top of like, is this the right thing we should be doing? And that's quite a thing. So you must have somehow been able to also put your arm around a lot of people to get them to buy into this trust in that process.
Yeah, well, I learned, and I think you certainly learned, the type of people that could succeed in that environment. And it wasn't necessarily the type A personalities, as you say, with the highly driven big egos. It was normally people who had a certain empathy for others, a certain perceptiveness for understanding the wider problem. So I think you and I, actually, Brian, became quite good at we could tell almost without...
whether passed the Ornella test.
Yeah, if they could pass the Ornella test, indeed. But certainly, when people arrived in the organization, and my colleagues were equally good at this, by the way, you could see whether people were likely to succeed or not.
Yeah. Let's shift gears a little bit. And Alex, I know you want to talk about technology today and the rapid pace of change we're seeing in technological advancements. Alex, hand over to you.
Yeah, I'm really keen to explore your perspective on technologies that have taken the business by storm. And I'm referring to generative AI and large language models, but also looking at other technologies that, as a global CIO for a global company, such as cloud, machine learning, and others that you've had to deal with. Love to hear your perspective. How different is it to some of the technologies that you were implementing at WBA?
Oh, it's definitely changing this and it's accelerating. I think every generation of leaders says that. But if I look back, I don't need to look back that far. But what I was doing 5, 6, 7 years ago was the mobile digital revolution, which is kind of, you know, everything's digital now. And organizationally, even chief digital officers are kind of being replaced with other new and creative titles, which you referenced in your last podcast, actually, Alex. So I think the first thing is you have to, as a technologist, you have to be able to kind of unlearn some of the things that were very important. So these waves come. What's happening now, though, is tech is definitely getting faster. Tech is converging more. And those are probably the two single biggest influences. So, I mean, everyone's talking about AI, but there's not just big AI, there's also small AI, which is already starting to be used in many organizations to change business process, to create efficiencies, to speed up development. I was following the other day Y Combinator, the startup accelerator in the US. And you know, this really would blow your mind if you look at what some of these technologies can do in terms of disruption to any type of industry. A lot of focus on media and content generation. I was also fascinated by what's happening in the healthcare space. It costs, I think, about $30 to sequence the human genome now, to get data out from the human genome. That's a figure that was $100,000 when it was first sequenced back in about 1990. So the cost of doing these sorts of things in healthcare are so much less now. The ability to use AI imaging to look at scans, to look at personalized medicine is phenomenal. So we're moving into an age where the AI will not just be something that somebody goes to for a particular solution, but it will become embedded in almost everything that we do, in every object that we touch, in every service that we get. I don't think we really fully understand the implication of this. So if I was in my old job now, I think you have to experiment with the technology, you have to work with partners who know it, and you have to also put a little bit of money aside to play and be prepared to fail, because probably a lot of the things that are being experimented on now will not be the future solution. It's a difficult world. We might just touch a little bit on how technology organizations should arrange themselves, should organize themselves to deal with this.
And given this rapid phase of change, especially when it comes to generative AI and some of the examples that you mentioned, would you have changed your approach for technology adoption if generative AI, for example, was available in the midst of your role as a global CIO, and how would you adopt it?
Interesting. So when I was at Walgreens, I made kind of two important decisions. It's a retail and a healthcare pharmacy organization. And I made a decision that in the retail space, actually, we were going to go with a best-in-class system, SAP S/4HANA, which was very new at the time. But the reason for that was I couldn't see anything that we were doing in retail that was sufficiently differentiated from what other companies were doing. Yes, of course, Walgreens did certain things better, and it could use that technology very effectively to take advantage of its position. However, look at pharmacy. Pharmacy is totally unique. Walgreens is a leader in pharmacy and that technology. You can't buy that off the shelf. So we used a lot of the available technologies at the time to build healthcare and pharmacy platforms for Walgreens, for Boots, that enable them to take advantage of that. And those are the things that really give competitive advantage. So translate that into today's world. Yeah, an organization should say, where can we use AI and in the future quantum and all the other technologies, the converged technologies, in a unique way, which makes our company differentiated? And where should we just be piggybacking on the work that somebody else is doing, maybe to create efficiencies in supply chain or whatever. So I think the principles probably never change. The technologies will always change, but an experienced leader will be able to identify what to take and what to leave behind and not just get caught up with the latest wave.
Anthony, let's talk about some of the activities you're involved in, the non-executive and the advisory roles that you're doing. Can you tell us a little bit about that 2019-2020 time?
You referenced our cycle rise during that period of time. We had a lot of time to really think about what I personally wanted to do going forward and how I could best use my skills and my experience with other organizations. So I think on the stuff I do in a non-exec and advisory and board level has proven to be really interesting. I hadn't quite appreciated when you are focused on one organization, albeit a very exciting organization, it doesn't necessarily give you the breadth of what you see when you're working across multiple companies. So I get to see a huge amount, and I'm actually sometimes humbled to give these companies the benefits of my experiences. It's interesting that the things that you do that sometimes you think are just common sense are very interesting insights for organizations. So it's interesting work. I enjoy that. That's one area of activity. What I find particularly fascinating, though, is the startup world, the early stage companies that I've invested in. So back in 2020, and we decided to put a little bit of money aside to invest in these early stage companies, using some of the experience I had working with the M&A team at Walgreens and other companies. But really, I was also sort of indulging my passion a little bit for some of these areas. So it turns out it wasn't necessarily just in healthcare or just in retail that I found companies. But I've got about 10 or so small companies, some of which are doing some interesting things. I mean, let's talk about the healthcare space for a moment. I work with a company called Mitra Bio, which is based out of Cambridge in the UK. And they're doing next generation non-invasive skin testing using epigenetic technology. So effectively, instead of having to do a biopsy of skin, using a strip, you can take a sample of DNA, have that sequence, and then you can use that to see the effects of products or therapies. Great for companies like Boots or L'Oreal to see the real effectiveness of their products. Great for companies who are more deeply in healthcare and looking at things like the risk of cancer and skin disease. So that's one example.
Anthony, can I jump in? What role do you play? I mean, you'll play a number of roles, I'm sure, but what's the core role that you play in that organization?
Yes. And so with Mitra Bio, I'm an investor and an advisor to them. So I try to help them think about where they're going with their strategy, the type of companies that they can work with, where their technology might be applicable. I do not get involved in the genetic sequencing, just in case you bring that.
Help them think about how would a big organization consume their technology, that type of thing.
Exactly, because they're a very small organization. The other company that I could maybe reference is a company called Airponics, which is back to my first startup in some ways. They're a disruptive agri-tech startups, and they use fog-based technology to grow crops in specialized facilities. So the fog is sprayed onto the roots of the crops. They get high yields, are using very little water and very little energy. So this is really interesting. In fact, this company, I'm going to join the board of this company because I think they've really got some great prospects, particularly in regions of the world where there's water shortage, where we've got climate issues as well.
I was just thinking if you were to give advice to an organization thinking about bringing in someone with your backgrounds, and whether you're in a tech startup or whether you're a PE firm or whether you're a more traditional company looking for an NED, and they were looking at people like you.
I think it's a huge benefit for organizations because for many years, there was no technology representation on boards, let alone even the executive teams. And that's starting to change. And we see the rise of the tech NED in some organizations. But in a way, that kind of does a little disservice to the role, because when I work on a board or supporting an organization, I try to give my whole self. So I give the benefit of my experiences in technology, but also in other areas as well. And if a board is recruiting a non-exec, they don't say, oh, we've got this person just because they've got financial knowledge or because they can read a balance sheet or because they understand sales or whatever. No, they take the whole person. And I think it's also incumbent on technology leaders who may be moving into this new stage of their careers to also make sure they are sufficiently well-rounded people. I don't think boards necessarily just want to get a techie on the board. That doesn't really help. But what they want is somebody who can work at that nexus of technology, strategy, of transformation, all of those things which are going to be very important for companies.
Well, that takes us almost to the end of our podcast, Anthony. I was going to ask you what's next for Anthony, but there's so much going on. Is there anything next?
I'd like to sort of deepen some of these things that I currently do, but I don't think there'll be any great changes. I shall enjoy watching all of my number twos and number threes become number twos and number ones in the world of technology, as they are all doing, actually. And yeah, that's where I am at the moment.
Well, we haven't had dinner since, I think it was December. We had a nice dinner in Isabel. So I'm going to leave it to you to organize the next one. But great to have you. Thank you very much for a fantastic talk today.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you very much, Alex. Thanks, Brian.
Well, we've come to the end of the show and the section where we look back at the key takeaways from the conversation with Anthony. And wow, there was a lot to unpack. I took five key takeaways in no particular order, but I thought the first takeaway, of course, was around leadership and alignment. Anthony's ability as a people leader was super evident throughout the conversation in his ability to align the ambitious goals of the shareholders and executive team at Walgreens Boots Alliance, most notably Stefano Pessina and Ornella Barra. He, in my experience, really married the ambition with the technological advancements that were happening at the time, and of course with people and the team that he fostered a culture of trust and empowerment through his One IT. Second, I think navigating cultural differences, Anthony's extensive experience across big corporations like UPS and PepsiCo equipped him with the ability to immerse himself in diverse organizational cultures, particularly the experience he had in Rome with the NGO, working in a non-governmental military organization, adapting to a very different culture there, showcases ability to really effectively adapt and integrate into a number of different operational cultures. And he was quick to point out that no culture is necessarily right or wrong, good or bad. It's really the culture you have to operate within and lead. We talked about his career path. I think he was very honest around his career progression from an early stage, taking advantage of opportunities as they arose, rather than necessarily meticulously planning every step. This approach really allowed him to traverse various roles and industries with rich experience. And I think his advice to those setting out in their career is not to be overly concerned about planning these things. Just allow some opportunity to happen, serendipity to happen, but be focused and be ready to take those opportunities. I think that served him well throughout his career. And even as we talk about his non-executive career, that served him well. And that was point four. Currently, Anthony holds significant roles on the boards of companies like Hitachi Digital Services, Rackspace, Photon, but he's also actively involved in the startup ecosystem, advising and investing in numerous ventures. He shared with us two really good examples where he's actively investing and taking a role there. I think that's very interesting as he's bridging his experience of executive leadership into some of these earlier stage startup companies, giving them the benefit of his experience. But maybe we could close on the other work that he's doing, the stuff that gives him personal fulfillment, which is around philanthropy, giving back, as he talked about it, his passion for Italy and his engagement in his role in Venice in Peril illustrate his commitment to giving back and balancing business success with personal satisfaction and cultural enrichment. So I'd say great conversation. I've known Anthony a long time. Wish him well, and we look forward to speaking with you again on our next podcast. Thank you.